On August 26th, Alaskans will vote yes or no on four different ballot measures. Tonight, KSKA examines ballot measure 3, a bill providing for public funding in campaigns, and ballot measure 4, a bill providing for regulation of water quality. The political advertisements are overwhelming and inescapable, but where are the facts you need to make an informed decision at the voting booth? KSKA hopes we can help. Tonight, we present opposing perspectives on each ballot measure. The program is hosted by the nonprofit group Alaska Common Ground and was recorded on Wednesday, August 20th at the Wilda Marston Theater. In the first half of the program, Tim June and Ken Jacobus debate ballot measure 3, known by advocates as the Clean Elections Initiative. Dr. Bruce Switzer and Lorna Shaw take the stage in the second half of the forum, arguing for and against ballot measure 4. One side calls it the Clean Water Initiative, the other calls it the anti-mining measure. Now is your chance to get the information needed to make up your own mind. Bill Falsey of the Alaska Common Ground serves as moderator in the first debate.
Well, hello everyone. My name is Bill Falsey, and on behalf of Alaska Common Ground and in partnership with AARP, the League of Women Voters, and Commonwealth North, I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's forum. Alaska Common Ground is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization dedicated to encouraging Alaskans to discuss important public policy issues, and we've organized tonight's event in service of that mission. For more information about our organization, I and the rest of the Alaska Common Ground board members encourage you to visit our website at www.akcommonground.org. Our event tonight will proceed in two parts. In the first half of the program, we will take up ballot measure 3, referred to by advocates as the Clean Elections Initiative. And at 8:15, we will turn to ballot measure 4, which is characterized variously as the Clean Water or Mining Shutdown Initiative. I will serve as moderator for the first half of the program. Cliff Groh will take over at the halfway point. Joining us for each measure will be representatives selected by the initiative sponsors and by the groups who authored the statements in opposition to the measures, which are included in the voter's guide prepared by the Division of Elections. We'll invite each speaker to begin with an opening statement of no more than 4 minutes, and then allow the panelists to put a few questions to each other. We have also reserved what I hope is ample time for you to put your questions to the panelists. Pens and note cards will be distributed, and we would ask that you pass your written questions to the aisle. Will it be collected either by board member Kevin Waring or Kari Gard, and they will deliver them to the stage. Peg Tileston, our board president, will serve as timekeeper tonight. Also, because time is extremely limited, we would ask that you keep any applause to the end of the presentation. We're going to begin tonight with ballot measure 3, which proposes a system of public financing for campaigns to elective public office. Speaking in support of the measure, and seated closest to me, is Tim June. Mr. June is the chair of Alaskans for Clean Elections and is a prime sponsor of ballot measure 3. He is a boat shop owner and longtime commercial fisherman who has lived in Haines for 32 years. He describes himself as a longtime volunteer grassroots advocate who's focused on issues of cancer prevention, fish habitat protection, cruise ship pollution, and public policy. He has served on numerous statewide boards and governor's task forces, has a policy advisor to Governor Tony Knowles, and has also twice been a candidate for State House and State Senate. Speaking in opposition to the measure and seated to Mr. June's left is Ken Jacobus. Mr. Jacobus is an attorney in private practice here in Anchorage and has been a leading advocate against ballot measure 3. He's practiced law in Alaska since 1968, has expertise in numerous subject matter areas, and has served as a member of the Army Reserve for 30 years. He's affiliated with numerous professional organizations and has served as chairman of the Alaska Bar Association's Ethics Committee, on the state legislature's Constitutional Revision Task Force, as the attorney for the Iditarod Trail Committee, and as legal counsel to the Alaska Republican Party. He currently serves as treasurer of the Anchorage Bar Association. I'm going to begin tonight with Mr. June, but to help orient our discussion, a brief summary of what ballot measure 3 proposes to do. When Alaskans go to the polls on August 26th, they will read this. Ballot measure 3, a bill providing for public funding in campaigns. This bill creates a voluntary program of public funding for state election campaigns. To qualify, candidates must collect a certain number of signatures and $5 campaign contributions from voters in the area in which the candidate is running for office. Qualified candidates that agree to campaign fundraising and spending limits may receive campaign funding from the state of Alaska based on office sought. A qualified candidate may receive state matching funds if the candidate is opposed by a candidate that does not take part in the program. And for those of us who are slightly more visual learners, the system would work roughly as depicted in this flowchart, which is adapted by one prepared by the measure's advocates. Before the primary election, a candidate would declare at filing whether he or she was interested in receiving state funds. If the candidate is not interested, they would proceed under present law. That's on the right of the slide. If the candidate does desire public funding, he or she would have to collect signatures and $5 contributions from registered voters, as few as 200 to run for state house in the primary, as many as 3,000 to run for governor. The candidate could also collect a limited amount of seed contributions to help facilitate this early collection of signatures and qualifying contributions. If able to collect the necessary number of signatures and contributions, candidates who then additionally agreed to abide by fundraising and spending limits, which would limit the amount they could receive from a political party and prohibit the candidate from spending his or her own money to campaign, they would then receive $16,000 to run for a House seat or as much as $250,000 to run for the governor in a primary. Those who then prevail in the primary would receive additional funds so long as their party's candidates captured 10% of the total votes cast in the primary. The additional funds would be as little as $24,000 to run for state house, as much as $500,000 to run for governor. Last, the measure also contains a matching provision. If a candidate who is receiving public funds is outspent by a privately funded opponent, the publicly financed candidate will receive an additional allotment of money equal to the amount by which they have been outspent, up to three times the amount of money the candidate initially received from the state. Should this initiative become law, we'll begin with Tim June.
Yes, thank you, Bill. I'd like to thank the members of Alaska Common Ground for this opportunity and for the members of the audience for showing up for this series of debates. My name is Tim June. I'm the chair of Alaskans for Clean Elections. We're a coalition, a broad-based coalition of Alaskans from across the political spectrum working to get the big money out of elections in Alaska with ballot measure 3. We're a nonpartisan group. We represent, we have members from every political party in the state that have been involved with this. Public funding of campaigns, which is known as Clean Elections, is a proven voluntary system that makes elections about voters and ideas rather than lobbyists and big money. Clean Elections gets the big special interest money out of races. It focuses on voters and ideas. It levels the playing field. It decreases special interest influence, increases accountability to voters, attracts more diverse candidates, increases voter participation, increases voter turnout, and increases competition for seats. While some critics have questioned the system, it works well in seven other states. It enjoys some 80% public support in states where it's existed the longest, both Maine and Arizona. Very few things rise to that level of approval. On August 26th, we have an opportunity to, I think, pass the most important people's initiative since statehood, the Clean Elections Initiative. By voting yes for a bill providing for public funding of campaigns, we can adopt a well-proven system that will serve the people of Alaska for many years to come. We can finally take back control of our state government from the big money corporations and special interests that have severely compromised our political system. With clean elections, corporations and special interests can no longer buy their way into the halls of government with large campaign contributions. Special interest money is simply taken out of the equation. This puts people back in charge of our elections and our democracy. Candidates are no longer beholden to a few big donors, but are free to serve the interest of their voters who elected them. Best of all, with clean elections, when candidates do win, they don't owe anyone any special favors. So it will save our state billions of dollars in political paybacks. Clean elections laws are working well in other states. In Maine and Arizona, 4 out of 5 voters support publicly funded clean elections. In 2006, more than 83% of candidates in Maine's elections voluntarily chose to use clean elections. The positive results of clean elections are staggering. The influence of big money has decreased. Election races have become more competitive. Candidates have become more diverse. Voter turnout has increased, and civic engagement in the election process has gone up. Alaska's ongoing FBI investigations and the Vico scandal indicate a serious need to return accountability to our government. These past few years, we have witnessed Alaska legislators and lobbyists convicted of conspiracy, mail fraud, tax fraud, money laundering, and extortion. This is just not a few bad apples, it's the whole tree. In order to address the whole tree, we need to start with its root, and we all know that root is big money. Political corruption has cost Alaskans billions of dollars in lost revenues and even more in lost opportunity. Public funding of campaigns effectively removes big money and special interests from Alaska politics and allows critical issues to get the attention they deserve. As long as candidates must raise huge sums of private money to get elected, corruption will continue. Politicians inevitably serve those who finance their campaigns. The solution is simple. If we Alaskans choose to fund the candidates running for office, they will serve our needs. If we don't, special interests will continue to dominate our legislature. Clean elections is a proven solution that will serve Alaskans for generations to come. We can seize this opportunity to significantly improve our democracy with public funding of campaigns by voting yes for ballot measure 3. Let's make this 50th anniversary a real celebration for democracy by adopting clean elections that will serve us for the next 50 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. June. Mr. Jacobus?
Thank you. Nobody's in favor of dirty or dishonest elections. While the idea of clean elections is seductive, it's not really clean elections. All it is elections which are paid for by government money. It will not reduce corruption. It won't reduce the influence of special interest groups. Won't make the legislators more accountable. It will not produce a single positive change in Alaskan politics or elections. It'll simply make the process a lot more difficult because there's another layer of complicated governmental regulation put in place. There are going to be an additional half dozen or more employees that the state is going to have to hire. And we're going to be giving millions of our tax dollars to individual politicians. Now, I'm going to discuss only money initially and also how it works, how the studies have shown it's actually worked in other states, which is important. It's nice to say, hey, great theoretical things, but when the studies show how it actually works, the proof is in the pudding, and I'm going to discuss that in just a little bit. But the State of Alaska Fiscal Note, published in the official election pamphlet, states the potential costs to the state for the first election are approximately $12 million. It also recognizes that substantial additional funding mechanisms, as you saw up there, are available for additional situations where a publicly funded candidate is opposed by a candidate who does not take public funds, or where a publicly funded candidate has had independent expenditures supporting the opponent. This could increase the costs of the program substantially. Now, let's look at a couple of states where this has been put in place. Arizona is the state the proponents of publicly funded elections often cite. However, after a study of the Arizona system, Hayward Campaign promises a six-year review of Arizona's experiment with taxpayer-funded campaigns 2006, concludes that the Arizona system fails to deliver on its promises and costs the people of Arizona a lot of money and has actually reduced participation and confidence in government. University of Montana study, campaign finance laws and political efficacy evidence from the states, also concludes that public funding laws have a statistically significant negative effect on public views of whether the people have a say in their government or whether officials care. Only strong disclosure laws will produce a positive effect, but this isn't one of those. Let's take a look at New Jersey, and this is the latest report that I have. New Jersey did a pilot program for three House districts in 2005 and 2007. The summary of these conclusions is May 2008. Conclusions of the study were as follows for the stated purposes of government-funded election. Does it end influence of special interest money? Likely to fail, based on available research. Improve unfavorable opinion of the political process, mixed results, but in Arizona and Missouri it's been determined it reduces public opinion of the political process. levels the playing field for women, minorities, and persons of modest means. Failed. Reduced campaign spending. Failed. Provided more time for candidates to communicate with voters. Not known. Increased voter turnout. Failed. Stimulate voter involvement by encouraging small contributions from individuals. Unknown. Reduce the number of uncontested elections, maybe. End negative campaigning. Failed. Prevented out-of-state money from affecting New Jersey elections. Failed. We don't need to spend millions of dollars of Alaskan citizens' and taxpayers' money in a program which has failed. Sure, the politicians like to get free money. They like to get this public welfare so they don't have to pay for their campaigns. But if they get public money, they don't have to really contact the voters. They have no one that they're ultimately responsible to. And I think that's ultimately why public confidence is reduced when you give the people, the candidates, money to run for public office. Vote no. It's a waste of money for us, and it'll harm our system. It won't take special interest out of politics. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobus. We'll now have the first question for Mr. Jacobus from Mr. June. If you have a question you'd like to ask the panelists, please raise your hand. We have cards and pens.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Jacobus, in the voter pamphlet, and you just restated it, you say, and I quote, clean elections will not produce a single positive change. Yet in last week's radio debate that we had on Alaska Public Radio, you touted the comprehensive, non-biased study of the 2000 Maine report on clean elections done by the state of Maine. In that report, they conclude the following positive influences. It encourages first-time candidates to run for political office. It provides more choice to the voters, provides a more even playing field. It sharply reduces private contributions to candidates and allows participating candidates to spend more time with their voters. So my question to you is, do you find all five of these benefits to be negative?
Are these benefits negative? If it actually happens, no. Having more contact with the voters is not negative, but the other studies don't show that. So it maybe works in one state because of the conditions at that state, but I don't really think it does. And again, you know, part of it is the bias of the person who prepares the report. So, and I've, you know, that's the Maine study was prepared by something called Maine Commission on Governmental Ethics and the Election Practices, which I'm not sure who appointed it. It's got an assistant attorney general in there. That's got an executive director. I would guess it's hired by the state or by the legislature, but I don't know that for sure. Anyway, that's my answer.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess in that line of thinking, I do agree with you that source is everything, and
sure.
Your sources over the last week have seemed to be a moving target. But just for your information, the Hayward study was based from the right-wing think tank, the Goldwater Institute, that was authored for that. The study you referred to about the University of Montana, I believe you're referring to the study of the University of Missouri.
Missouri, right.
Yeah.
Right, Missouri.
Yeah. That study was also authored by someone who's active in the Cato Institute. And I don't know if the audience can see this, but this is a network of the different groups that nationally opposed clean elections and the network that they belong to. So it involves Goldwater Institute, Cato Institute, Center for Competitive Politics. And I think the point is here that Mr. Jacobus certainly has a right to oppose this, but the views he's offering are from a very narrow, well-funded groups nationally that are providing these studies and information. So I think they're anything but non-biased.
And
yes,
now a question for Mr. June from Mr. Jacobus.
Okay, let me try this one. We all know that Barack Obama rejected public funding for his presidential campaign. Does this mean that he's more corruptible because he takes private donations than if he had accepted public funding? And if your answer is that he is not more corruptible, then why would other candidates be more corruptible if they don't take public financing?
I don't mean to imply endorsement of any presidential candidate. However, my understanding is that Both Barack Obama and John McCain are strong supporters of public funding. Unfortunately, they are both also realists in terms of what's happened with our national public funding program is since 1982, when Jimmy Carter first got elected with public funding, the Congress has failed to increase the amount of money available to them. So, unfortunately, candidates for president are stuck with the reality that they can accept public funding and be totally overwhelmed with private contributions, or they have to bite the bullet and reject it and raise untold sums of money. And I'm certainly hopeful that we'll get to this program nationally so we can both correct the state problem and the national problem.
Well, I guess my response to that is that I'm not criticizing Mr. Obama either or Mr. McCain. But a crook is a crook regardless of the method of financing the elections. All of the Vico corruption was in violation of present law. If the legislators are going to be crooks, it will not matter how their candidacies are funded. Again, it's a waste of money. Let the people who want to run for office raise their own funds, and they'll still vote the same way.
A second question for Mr. Jacobus from Mr. June.
Let's see. Mr. Jacobus, you're a very accomplished man. I've read your background. It's very impressive.
Well, I appreciate that.
Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But you trumpet the salvation to corruption is through transparency. Yet in your professional life, you've consistently represented having unlimited soft money available, unlimited spending. The Committee Against Corruption, which I believe you're a member, that is the author of the so-called Anti-Corruption Initiative, which will be on the 2010 ballot, has failed to release any information about how much money they spent in their signature gathering phase and where that money may have come from. We at Clean Elections have been transparent from the beginning and released where every dollar has come from the signature gathering and in this campaign. So my question is, how do you justify your past actions as anything that is transparent?
Well, the Committee to Stop the Corruption filed every report that was required by law, and I don't believe I'm actually a member of the Committee to Stop Corruption. I'm assisting it, on this particular one, the Committee to Stop Corruption is not involved in opposing ballot measure number 3. I'm not paid for this. I was kind of drafted into it as a volunteer. And I do support other unusual things which are not necessarily conservative causes. Like, for example, I was very active in the campaign to try to legalize marijuana some years ago. And that's certainly not except for a few conservatives, it's generally not a conservative cause.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, and a final question for Mr. June from Mr. Jacobus.
Okay, let me just take a real simple example here, not complicated. If you decide on your own to buy a newspaper ad for $500 to support your privately funded candidate, the government will give the opponent $500 to counter your ad, but the government won't pay for your ad. Is this really fair, or is it constitutional?
Yeah, if I can respond to that. It depends where the privately funded $500 came from.
Oh, it came from an individual. You.
Oh, from
somebody in the audience pays $500 out of his own pocket to buy a newspaper ad.
I think in that case, if candidates were only funded with their own money, it would be problematic in that, first of all, only wealthy people could run for office, which seems to be the case these days anyway. However, under our current system, candidates not only use their own money, but they use the money of private contributors. And as we're seeing in the Vico corruption, those private contributors are many times have vested special interests, and they're not always transparent of who they are. Sometimes those contributions come through the wives of private special interest or through the families of private special interest. Or in the case of Vico, those contributions were later from employees of a company that were later reimbursed with corporate money. So I think that by suggesting public funding as a way of leveling the playing field, it really just takes into account how compromised our system has become over these years, and it gets it back so that money is no longer the determining factor of who wins an election. It's simply equal funding for equal candidates. Let them fight it out on the issues.
public funding doesn't really solve the problem of special interest groups being involved. Even if the people are publicly funded, just go down to Juneau. You see lobbyists camped out on a certain bench down in the halls of Juneau. They corner the legislators all the time. They help them write legislation. That's where your special interest will be affected, but it's not really public. It's kind of behind the scenes. Disclosure is the answer. Where does the money come from? The people should know who the candidates might be beholden to when they vote. It's disclosure is really the answer to this. It's not public funding.
And I'll turn to questions from the audience. We'll do as many of these as we can before we reach 8:15. The first one is for either panelist. Doesn't this measure just give money to marginal candidates? Would any candidates capable of raising funds actually use it?
Do you want to go first? Or?
Okay, I'll take a shot at it. This was the third question I was going to ask my opponent, and that's that what's the point of giving money to tax dollars to support the candidacy of someone that you don't support, or one of Alaska's certifiable wackos that nobody should be supporting at all? And we all know at least one political wacko. So why should the taxpayers support these marginal candidates? In order to run for a house race, all you have to do is get to 200 signatures, $5 from each person, governor $3,000. And I assume that the legislators who run for the House, well, maybe go door to door, but they go door to door anyway. The governor, who has to collect $3,000, may very well hire professional fundraisers, just like people hire professional fundraisers to get signatures on petitions. So I don't, it will provide support to marginal candidates that should not be in the election.
Do you have a response?
Yes. My response to that is this system requires for a House race that a candidate go out to the voters in their district and find 200 of them that will give them a $5 contribution and support them. My contention is that any individual that can go out and find 200 voters in their district that support them no longer fit what I think most of us would consider a wacko, although I hate to make that judgment on any candidate of any position. I think that Mr. Jacobus's argument that or question of why should we fund people that we don't agree with, I think that we can look to who gets elected under the present system, and we are continually paying a fairly hefty salary, be it a governor, lieutenant governor, representative, legislator, to people that we don't always agree with. It's part of the system. This Clean Elections is simply offering equal funding available. It's voluntary. People don't have to take it. But if they do, they have to show that broad base of support in order to qualify. So I think that it has a filter of its own. In the states that have had it, the aberrant candidate argument has always been used, and it has very rarely been the case that anybody's been successful getting through that high requirement for what candidates have to do to qualify.
This is a question about the mechanics of the initiative, and it's addressed to Mr. June. Isn't the provision providing for a match of funds spent by an opponent who doesn't take public funds an open-ended blank check on the Alaska Treasury? What's the experience in other states?
Yes, what we did in this, we looked at what past races cost. Generally, in 04 and 06, the average House race was about $53,000 to $55,000. But that's a range from Mary Kapsner's district out in Bethel, Mary Nelson. Mary spends about $12,000 for her district, but we certainly know most of you are from Anchorage, and we know that urban districts cost in the $120,000 to $130,000 range. What we chose to do with Clean Elections and matching funds, we recognize that because urban districts require television ads to be competitive, that we wanted that to be available if a Clean Election candidate is opposed by a non-participating candidate that's using private contributions. And so what we did is we took the base of what we hope campaigns will eventually come, which is $40,000, and we allowed there to be dollar-for-dollar match up to $120,000. We thought that was an adequate amount for anybody to get their message out, to be competitive in races. We're trying to be fiscally responsible. This is not something that's going to cost the state very much money at all. relative to this last $14 or $16 billion budget. This is going to cost a percent of a percent of a percent. It comes out to, if you divide the budget equally amongst us all, we get about $22,500 in services and benefits per year from the state. Clean elections will cost $9 of that $22,500. So it's about the prices of a couple of cups of coffee a year. That's not too much to ask for good government.
And we have a question that is addressed to Mr. Jacobus, but if there's differing views, you're welcome to jump in. How much funding and manpower would you expect that it would take to administer the program?
Well, the state has actually made an estimate in the official election pamphlet of to how much money it would take to administer the program. And I just have to look at the official election pamphlet here. But my recollection is about $12 million for the first day election with additional amounts which might be possible because of the rescue provisions. And by rescue provisions, what I mean is the provisions which say that you have a candidate who outspends you or a candidate who has independent contributions, then you get more money. So $12 million plus the hiring of six additional people to administer a layer of complicated regulations. I think that's about what it is. And the Alaska Public Offices Commission, I think, which would be tasked with this, is presently It's underfunded. It's not able to do anything really much except fine people for late filing of campaign reports. And that's about it. So to try to administer a complex program like this, I think, is just close to being out of the question.
Yes, and we certainly depended on the state of Alaska and APOC to come up with that figure. I believe they came up with about $460,000 a year in administrative costs, which is four full-time positions and two part-time positions. One of the things that we did to simplify their job is we were suggesting in districts that credit cards are available, candidates would simply be issued debit cards for the public funding of campaigns. The beauty of that system is that those debit card results come directly back to APOC. They don't even necessarily go to the candidate. So you can see exactly what a candidate's spending, how they're spending it, when they're spending it. And I think the thing that we have to remember, it's not the incremental cost of this, but it's the tremendous cost that is going to happen if we don't do it. You know, we have to understand that we're paying for campaigns whether we know it or not. You look at the 2006 PPT tax vote, that one vote alone in 1 year where the legislators through the influence of VICO and other special interests, they voted for the very lowest tax available at that particular time. That cost us at least $1 billion for that 1 year. That $1 billion would have paid for every clean election governor, lieutenant governor, senator, representative for the next 200 years, just that one special interest favor. So that's what we're losing out, and that's what we've been funding up to this point. We want to change that and bring it down so it's $9 a year.
I have two questions that relate to the 10% threshold. The first is, how does a 10% threshold in a primary to qualify increase diversity? And the second reads, if all you need is 10% of the primary vote to move on and get public funding in the general election, why won't we just get a lot of crackpots and not serious politicians? Won't it just result in a lot of not serious candidates?
Well, I think we kind of answered that. I'm not necessarily sure you're talking about 10%. For the primary, you're talking about 200 people in a House district.
Maybe you could clarify the mechanics.
Which is roughly 10%, I guess, maybe a bit more. But I think that it's easy for a crackpot to get on the ballot. I mean, people will sign these petitions, and I strongly believe in petitions, but it's easy to tell people to get people to sign petitions. You just say, well, you know, you don't have to say you're for it or against it. Just put it on the ballot and let the people vote. You know, put this guy on the ballot, let the people vote.
Yeah, and I think in answering that 10% threshold question, I know that had come up through the campaign, and what we tried to do is strike a balance in that. And the concept is that if you're a recognized party candidate, it's a simpler process in terms of how you qualify for general election funding. For those that are either independent candidates or from minority parties, they have to show in the primary that they've gotten at least 10% of the voters that support them. So it's a high bar for minority party candidates. It's not anything that's definitely going to allow crackpots through the door, because that's a lot of work to get 10% of the vote, especially if you're not running with a recognized party. So that's something that we hope will be workable. Our thought is that this is allowing candidates a significant amount of primary money, and we hope that they take that and go out into the voters in their district and get that 10% support. We recognize that it's a challenging task, but we think that people that have that broad base of public support will be able to do it.
This question asks, how many candidates would be reasonably expected to use the system, and what's the incentive to use it if they have the ability to raise private funds?
Yeah, I guess I'll start with that. What we've seen in other states, generally this is a system that takes 2 to 3 election cycles to come into its own. So we're anticipating Alaska will have a similar result. In the state of Maine, the first election cycle had a 30% participation in clean elections. The second cycle, it was up to 60. And now they're in the third and fourth cycle, and they're above 83% participation. So I think that this is something that it takes a while for candidates, for voters, for legislators to get used to. Once they do, there's no turning back, because people recognize, you know, what were we thinking before? You know, this is so clear, so simple, so right, that there is no going backwards. So we're anxious to begin this process after Tuesday. It will not come in place until 2010. That'll be the first election that it'll be available, and we'll proceed from there.
One can understand why this happens, because politicians are addicted to public money that they don't have to go out and earn or raise themselves. 30%, 40%, 50%, that's not a surprise, because you know, we in Alaska are used to getting free money. And if we can get free money to run for public office, we'll be happy to take it. And I don't think that's the right thing for government to do, to pay people to run for public office.
Yeah, I think to counter that, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do here is bring down the cost of elections. So the counterintuitive thing about this clean elections, the more people that get involved, actually the less the system costs the state, because when you have what we're eventually trying to get to is going to be clean election candidate versus clean election candidate. For House races, those races will then be limited to $40,000 maximum for each candidate. So we won't have these $120,000, $150,000 races in Anchorage anymore. It makes it more accessible to people. People from different backgrounds can run. People from different socioeconomic opportunities can come to this, and this is also something that has been very empowering to women. The state of Maine, one of the most significant statistics that came out of that, by my thinking, 72% of the women candidates who used public financing said they would not have even run for office if this hadn't been available to them. So, you know, we look at the state of Alaska, where we have a very diverse population. We're underrepresented in the legislature. I believe we have less than 21% of our legislators are women. So we look at that underrepresentation, and we see clean elections is going to be a real help for them to have access and be competitive in races. And I think that's going to change the decisions the legislature makes, and it's going to change what topics they decide to address. So I'm very excited about those changes.
Another question about the mechanics of the bill. Do the people who give the candidate the $5 contributions have to be registered to vote in that district?
Yes.
Yes, we both agree on that.
Yes. Yes, they do, and it has to be verified by the Public Offices Commission staff before anybody receives public funding.
And then perhaps a related question. This one's written for Mr. June, but of course either of you are welcome to answer. Is there anything to stop special interest groups from using the system to put forward candidates using the public dime, as they can swamp neighborhoods with members of their special interest group to collect the signatures and the $5 contributions?
Well, there is a mechanism. One thing that Groups can't go out and willy-nilly collect for a candidate of their choice. We put it within the realm of the existing system, so somebody collecting on behalf of a candidate has to be a registered deputy treasurer of that candidate's campaign. They have to be publicly identified. But what we've seen in states in the past for state Senate, state House districts, you know, the candidates themselves are the ones that go into the district to look for the $5 contributions. They want to talk to their voters. They want to know their contributors. You know, they don't want to send a surrogate out there who is going to collect the money, and they're going to miss that opportunity to introduce themselves personally. So this is something that in other states, it's most always been the candidates themselves collecting those small $5 contributions.
You know, my response to that is if I'm a candidate going door to door, as most candidates do in urban districts, I want to say, vote for me because this is my political philosophy. Oh, and by the way, just like the gentleman on the corner, I want you to give me $5. I mean, it's an embarrassing thing to do, but I suppose it could be done. But the specific question was, is there anything to prevent special interest groups from overwhelming the system? You know, I don't believe so. If almost any system that we set up, if somebody wants to act illegally or dishonestly or figure some way around it or some way to manipulate it, they'll do it.
This one starts with a declaration. As a taxpayer, I have serious concerns about my tax dollars being used to fund attack ads and spin doctor salaries. And then the question asked is, do you believe that political contributions are a form of free speech?
Is that for me or for
either?
Yeah, go ahead.
Definitely, it's definitely a form of free speech, and as a matter of it's definitely a form of free speech.
And I think we'll agree on that. That's the Buckley versus Vallejo 1976 decision that the Supreme Court decided that money is free speech. We certainly agree to this, and this system does not challenge that notion in any way, shape, or form. It's voluntary. If candidates choose to use it, fine. If they choose not to use it, go out and raise private contributions. They have the freedom to do that, and that can be as much money as they can raise and spend on a campaign. It doesn't impede that free speech right.
This question is looking for some context, I think. How much money has been contributed by special interest groups in the past few years in the oil industry, and which candidates have received the lion's share? If you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'll give a shot at that. One of the things that I think in terms of people that are concerned about the incremental cost to the state, you know, we have to look at, let's look at the year 2006. And this was from a Juno Empire article called Millions for Billions. In that article, it pointed out that in 2006, there was $9 million spent during the legislative session by lobbying interest. And that's just to wine and dine legislators. That did not include the $15.9 million for salaries for lobbyists that year. British Petroleum alone spent $4.7 million on lobbying in 2006. So you look at clean elections, you know, just to give us a relative reality, clean elections is looking at having the state of Alaska spend no more than $6 million a year. We're up against $4.7 million just from British Petroleum. So that's the kind of competition that's out there. That's who's paying for candidates. That's who's paying for elections. So we are suggesting that we be competitive, and this would allow us to do that.
Well, this is kind of the way it would work. I haven't gotten a penny from the oil industry, and I've gotten a penny for what I'm doing here. But if the oil industry, for example, is prevented from making contributions to candidates, then they'll simply spend their money on independent expenditures. And once an independent expenditure is made, then the government has to match the oil company independent expenditures. They give the money that the oil companies spend on behalf of one candidate to the opposing candidate. So it's going to end up costing us a lot of money because now we're going to have to match the oil company contributions, whereas we didn't have to do this before. Up to certain limits, there are certain limits on this, but that's the general idea.
Yeah, so I guess my response is, don't we want to match the oil companies' money? You know, do we want them to be out there by themselves with their $5 or $6 million a year putting out those ads? What we did with this Clean Election Initiative, having the benefit of hindsight and looking at the seven other states that had it in place, we were able to look at the problems they had. And indeed, Mr. Jacobus is right that, that money shifted away from candidate expenditures to independent expenditures. And so what we did in our initiative to address that is that if independent expenditures are made either for or against a clean election candidate, it could trigger matching funding from the state to allow them to counter whatever that expenditure was. So it's a way, again, to second guess what might happen and to put this in place before it does happen.
May I make one more comment on this? And this is really kind of interesting, because there are rescue provisions in the federal law. It's called the Millionaire's Amendment. If a millionaire spends a certain amount of money, then the federal election law would allow additional money to be given to counter what the millionaire candidate spent. The Supreme Court in June ruled that this is unconstitutional because it's an infringement on the right of the person who's speaking. It places an undue burden on him. Now, if somebody makes an independent expenditure, and because of the fact that you make an independent expenditure, your money, the state matches that money and gives it to your opponent, that places a real burden on your ability to make this expenditure in the first place or your desire to do it because you're generating more money for your opponent. So I think that the rescue provisions, according to the Johns what is it called? It's called Jones versus Federal Election Commission. I think the rescue provisions are unconstitutional, besides being a bad idea. It hurts your right to make independent expenditures because by doing it, it generates additional money for the other side. So I think that part of the campaign finance law will be thrown out by the court, the rescue provision. So we will save some money if it passes, but the basic problem is still there.
This question asks, why $5? Why not $1? Why not $10?
I'll answer that. We researched other states' experience, and I think Mr. Jacobus referred to something before of how easy it is to get people to sign petitions. We recognize that. We're used to petitions in the state of Alaska. Sometimes we're signing two or three at a time. We do that, I think, generally fairly casually. You know, you review the issue. We want things to have a public airing. I think Alaskans in general are very curious about discussing public policy and allowing those mechanisms to happen. But what states found is that by simply requiring this minor $5 contribution, it had a significant change in people's casual support in signing of a candidate. And, you know, I last spring spent quite a few hours in the legislative halls because we had clean election bills that were introduced. And so I was talking to legislators about this process. And it was really curious to me. And it didn't matter if they were Republican or Democrat. I really couldn't predict it. But on the one hand, some legislators were afraid that, well, this is just going to make it so easy for an opponent to come out and compete against them that, you know, we need to get rid of it. But then as we go through the discussion, this happened a number of times, that legislators would say, you know, I'm not even sure I could go into my own district and get that many signatures and $5 contributions. So I think that one of the great things with the number of signatures required, we looked at other states and we took our best guess of what would suit Alaska. But in this clean election system, the beauty of it is that's an adjustable number. So if we find that we have 20 candidates in a primary and that, you know, people are finding 200 signatures very easy, then it's a very simple thing to up that number and say, maybe we'll require 300 the next year, or maybe we won't have any candidates that can qualify. I think the state of Massachusetts or one of them required 800 signatures and one person qualified for the cycle. So the signature is the kind of variable adjustment mechanism in that. And I should say, we went out of our way to adapt this specifically to Alaska. And one of the things that we did, recognizing that $5 is a lot of money in a rural village in Alaska, we put a clause in that the state will determine a mechanism that a citizen can simply check a box and say, I make under the federal poverty guideline, please waive this $5. So this allows every Alaskan to participate in elections that wants to, and we're excited about that.
This card has two questions, and I'm not quite sure I understood the first, so I apologize if I'm mingling this. Why would the cost of a House election drop from $125,000 if the reason it costs $125,000 is TV and the cost of getting the message out? And the second question, a clean elections incumbent against a clean elections newcomer has a heck of an advantage under the system, right?
Yeah, could you repeat the first one? I didn't quite get
that. Well,
I'm
not quite sure I get it either.
Okay.
So I solicit a clarification from whoever this question came from. Why would the cost of a House election drop from $125,000 if the reason it costs that amount is TV and the cost of getting the message out?
Oh, the reason why the cost will drop is because when we get our 60 or 80% buy-in and we have many of our campaigns that are going to be clean election candidates versus clean election candidates, they have a set amount of money that they're going to receive, and they have to choose how they're going to spend that. Maybe that won't allow for as much television advertising. I should say that some of the responses I've gotten around Alaska was people said, does this mean there'll be less political ads on TV? And I said, well, possibly. And they said, I'll vote for it just for that. You know, so we don't intend to do that. Candidates are free to spend the money however they see fit. They might see that spending it on their $40,000 on television advertising might be the best bang for the buck. We're not controlling that. That's up to them. But the thing is, it's going to be an equal amount of money, and candidates are going to have to be creative about how they're going to use that because it's going to be significantly less than what some of them have been used to. As to the second part on incumbency, it's true incumbents will always have an advantage. There are other ways that can be addressed, but what this does is it takes care of the money part of the thing. Incumbents typically outspend challengers by 3-1. In primaries, they sometimes outspend them by as high as 13-1 in Alaska. So what this does, it's going to offer dollar for dollar match, equal funding. So the incumbents are going to have they're going to have a horse race. You know, I think that's why. Believe me, when I've been talking to legislators in Juneau, there are a lot of them that are giving this serious thought because it frankly frightens some of them. And, you know, I know I've been a candidate in the past. It takes years to build up your donor base, and there's a lot of comfort that people have, you know, knowing that they can, you know, tap these certain donors over and over again. A challenger has to start from scratch, and that's why it's so difficult for challengers.
Name recognition certainly assists incumbents. And to some extent, in order for a challenger to get name recognition, he has to spend more money than an incumbent. I'm not exactly sure how that will work out when you talk about clean election incumbent versus clean election challenger. Both of them are going to be limited in their expenditures. And I think what's going to happen, as the experience in other states is showing, is that you're going to get a lot more independent expenditures to cover the fact that the people who are running can't actually get their message out with the money that they're authorized to spend. Political advertising, even though it may be annoying to us, is a way of conveying the candidate's message to the public. And the more the message is conveyed to the public, the more the public is advised. The more the candidates are cut off because they can't spend money to convey their message, the more ignorant the public is. The elections aren't going to get any cheaper. The prices of TV aren't going to go down. The price of radio and newspaper ads aren't going to go down. So in order to get the message out, the message is going to have to be covered by independent expenditures, which, you know, aren't really even disclosed as well as the expenditures which are made directly by the candidate. So you don't have the disclosure. You don't really know, except to some extent, who's making the independent expenditures, whereas the candidate has specific requirements that have to be followed in order to make these expenditures, and they have to be reported.
This question says, clean elections sounds like a marketing slogan. Why isn't it called public funding of elections, which is what it is?
Actually, it has a number of names. Clean Elections was the original movement that is known nationally in most other states. There are bills in, I believe, 30 other states to adopt clean elections. Alaska, we simply took what was commonly known to be the movement. There is a new title that's being used. It's called voter-owned elections, which probably more accurately describes it. So we're just keeping with what is the soup of the day. Public funding, fine. You know, they're both interchangeable. I think that it's important that Alaskans understand that what this is going to do, and it's definitely going to improve things in the state of Alaska.
A clean elections actually is a marketing phrase. The lieutenant governor refused to allow that to be placed on the ballot. What you're going to be voting on is taxpayer-funded elections. I hadn't heard this voter-owned elections, but really, in order to say it accurately, if you use that type of phrase, you're talking about the government-owned elections, because it's government money that's being used to pay for these elections. When we're joking about this, we call this the Welfare for Politicians bill. But calling it clean elections is marketing. It doesn't guarantee that the election is going to be clean at all.
Yeah, and I should counter that the jokes in our office are about the Welfare for Oil Companies election. So.
We still have time for more questions. So if you haven't asked yours yet, find Kari or Kevin. They still have cards. There's still opportunity for you to ask. This is a question that says, Mr. Jacobus, your position seems to rest solely on opposing the initiative without offering a solution for ending political corruption in Alaska. Do you have one? And if so, can you explain how it's better than the one proposed by the initiative? Or are you simply content with the current system as it is?
Oh, do I have a solution? Yes, more disc. It's the libertarian view. I think that personally, I think that people should be allowed to contribute as much as they want to whatever candidate they want, but there has to be immediate disclosure in a meaningful way so that the candidates, so that the voters will know who the candidates have received money from. Things like initiatives, you've got to be able to go all the way back to, you know, not to some organization in Washington, D.C., but to where the money actually comes from. It's disclosure that's important. It's not paying government money for elections. It's also not limiting the ability of people to spend their own money or even other people's money to get their message out. And also, the other initiative, which is going to be on in 2010, which would limit the government from spending money on certain things such as lobbying. Under that initiative, the government would be prohibited from hiring lobbyists to get their own government programs through the legislature, for example. That's something which would help clean up the process also. So, no, we do have positive solutions, but we also want to stop things which really are no solutions but will just create more problems, in our opinion.
Yeah,
in my opinion, here.
My response to that is I don't have a problem with a good part of that solution. Transparency is great. Instant reporting is great. We now have electronic media. Those things are possible, and it is... I think the problem comes just in the reality of people in our everyday lives. We work, take kids to school, we take kids to music practice. People are busy in their lives, and there are very few of us, and probably even in this room, that go to the APOC website in our spare time to stare at campaign contributors to particular campaigns. It's available. But, you know, I admittedly do it. I'm ashamed of doing it. I usually do it late at night after my wife's gone to bed. It's an embarrassing thing to have to do. And I don't think voters necessarily should have to do that. And the beauty with clean elections is you don't have to go to the APOC report, because you know that whoever the candidate is, they got $5 from whoever. Who cares? You know, $5 is not going to influence their decision on anything. It's from a voter in their district. They might be Republican, they might be Libertarian, they might be Green. It doesn't really matter. But what does matter is that that they are supported by voters in their district, that they're not supported by special interest, and that it's going to cure the corruption. And I think one thing I need to point out, in the recent indictment papers on Senator Cowdery in July that the FBI released. They recorded a conversation between the two VICO executives, Bill Allen and Rick Smith. And Smith said to Allen in that twice in these recorded conversations, he said, "The only leverage we have over legislators is either through campaign contributions or through fundraisers on the 20% PPT tax vote." So, you know, they could not have made our case any more clearly. Yes, legislators also took bribes, but, you know, the reigning kings of corruption in Alaska right now, VICO Corporation, I don't think we can find any better experts. This is their internal conversation that says the way that we control the game is through campaign contributions. And they've done a good job of it for the last 20 years.
Our discussion about nomenclature inspired one questioner to ask, "Taxpayer-owned elections. Alaskans don't pay taxes. Please comment."
Well, actually, Alaskans do pay taxes. People who are small business owners could pay taxes. We pay property taxes, but of course they don't go to the state. We pay gasoline taxes, at least until they were repealed. There are taxes that we pay. We just don't pay an income tax. That's correct. We pay sales taxes. And we pay, because the government taxes the oil companies, whatever the government taxes, it increases the price of the product, so we pay indirectly. The government gets its hand in our pocket in all sorts of different ways.
And this question says, "Welfare for politicians. How can this abuse be prevented? Can't marginal candidates get the required endorsements and then just live on the funding election after election?"
Yeah, I'll take that. I should say this system is serious business for clean elections. We wrote in very severe penalties for any abuses, sometimes paying back as much as 10 to 1 if there are any abuses. With clean elections, once the candidate takes the pledge that they're going to abide by the rules, it's a serious pledge. It's not something to be taken lightly. And one of the things, the only abuse that has been documented in the seven states that have it, I believe there were three libertarians in Arizona that ran under clean elections, and they decided to go out and party the money away in nightclubs and had a grand old time. Well, they had a grand old time until they were found out by the commission to be misspending funds. Clean elections requires that you spend the money on campaign related efforts. Of course, what else would we do? So, anyway, they were caught, they were jailed, they were prosecuted. They had to repay the money. I think one of them is actually still on the lam. So keep your eyes peeled.
I think there were a couple of people who abused the system in Maine too, but it isn't a serious issue. But with clean elections, but people who do have to take the public money do have to be policed to make sure that the public money is spent in an appropriate way. And I guess that's the reason for putting it on a debit card, which if you're going to do something, which you know, I think is a terrible idea, that's a good way to implement it.
Wow, thank you.
That is the last audience question I have, so I'll make another pitch for questions from the audience in the timing we have left. Failing any other audience questions, although we may have one here, I'll ask the panelists if they have any final thoughts that they'd like to share that stem from the discussion so far tonight. Well, I can ask this question first, give you some time to think about it. This one says, "Mr. June, you said that the VICO influence over the tax questions proves the need for a clean elections process. But didn't the exposure of this corruption cause the tax rate to end up higher than it would have been had Bill Allen not tried so hard to influence things? We lost $1 billion in 1 year, but we made more than make it up for it the next year, didn't we?"
Yes, absolutely. I don't think the oil companies were real pleased with what's happened in the last couple of years, having the FBI in state. One thing that I do want to point out, to me, as an Alaskan, I am personally offended that we've had to depend on the FBI and the Justice Department to point out the level of corruption that this state is involved in. We're just at the beginning of the indictments. This could go on and on for the next 3 or 4 years. I'm glad the FBI is here because, this is obviously a very serious problem that's been going on a long time. But I think that, we as Alaskans, as a state, we need to come together and to take care of our own. And, this investigation didn't happen because of the Public Offices Commission or the Legislative Ethics Committee or the Department of Public Safety or any of the entities that we have as safety stops. It's continued for years and years. So I think with Clean Elections, by adopting this, Alaskans are taking the very responsible position of saying, we're going to address corruption firsthand. This is unacceptable. We need to move on as a state and stop acting like a colony and letting these multinationals run our business. Yeah, thank you.
The feds being up here was actually quite interesting, and I supported it too. It's about time that our house was cleaned, regardless of how it was done. But I think that because of what's happened, we're going to have a whole generation of politicians that are actually totally scared about corruptions. We're not going to need publicly funded elections in order to scare them away from corruption. They're going to be so scared that they're going to act honestly for an entire generation, or at least as honestly as politicians can act.
Yeah, and I think that we do agree on that, but I think what we have to understand, it is the old adage, money will find a way. We've heard it before, and just as a side note, I spend quite a bit of time down in Juneau on different issues, and it's pretty comical right now. The Baranoff Bar has always been kind of the center point of the lobbyist legislative interaction, especially after hours, and now the game is that legislators no longer go to the Baranoff to have a drink with lobbyists. Their staffers go to the bar to have a drink with lobbyists. And so it's removed by one, by one magnitude. However, that staff interaction is certainly going right directly back to the legislature. So the problem has not been solved. And I think that in terms of the questioner asking about yes, we are getting billions of dollars more because of the corruption. I think it did push them quite a ways further that they had. But, you have to recognize that I first got involved with this really over one incident. I happened to be in Juneau in 2006, and I don't have television where I live. I don't have electricity. However, I was in Juneau. We're in a motel room, and you watch gavel to gavel. And I was watching an expert testify on the difference, the choice between the 20% or 35% PPT tax. That was the range that was offered us for some reason. And at the time, they were debating the difference between 20% or 21%. The legislature went through all of this pain and suffering about, oh, which one should we do? This is such a tough decision. Well, this particular expert, he'd been on the stand for about 2 hours, and frankly, he was just tired. And he said this. He said, frankly, in our office, we deal with countries all over the world. And he said, the difference between a 20% tax or a 35% tax, he said, it's a joke. He said, compared to what other countries are doing. And he caught himself. He realized what he had said. The whole room was shocked that he just freely admitted this. And he went back to kind of towing the line. But I should say that, you look at Alaska compared to the country of Norway, the same amount of oil over the same period of time in the same Arctic conditions. Norway has $380 billion in their permanent fund. We have $37 billion. Something's gone wrong here in the last 20 years, and we need to correct that.
Well, we're now reaching 8:15 and the conclusion of this portion of the program. Cliff Groh and the speakers assembled to address ballot measure 4 are going to take the stage now. But while they do that, I ask you to join me in thanking our panelists, Tim June and Ken Jacobus, for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
You're listening to a public forum on ballot measures 3 and 4, recorded by KSKA Public Radio on Wednesday, August 20th at the Wilda Marston Theater. In the first half of the forum, Tim June and Ken Jacobus debated ballot measure 3, a bill providing for public funding in campaigns. Now, Cliff Groh moderates the discussion on ballot measure 4.
Looking out at this very well-informed crowd, I can tell by looking, I'd urge you, if you've already formulated questions about ballot measure number 4, please get cards from either Kevin Waring. Kevin, could you stand here, the man in the white T-shirt standing up now, or Kari Guardia, raising your hand right there. And you can write out your questions as soon as possible so we can get them lined up. Thanks a lot to Bill and to the speakers previously. That was obviously very informative. And if people can sit down here and get set up in the microphones. We're going to go right into the forum on ballot measure number 4 so we can get as much discussion as possible on these two important propositions. And first of all, can you hear me both? Okay. Got the microphone set up? Okay. If adopted, ballot measure number 4 would impose water quality standards on new large-scale metallic mining operations in Alaska. Okay, I'm going to introduce the speakers here. Closest to me in speaking in favor of the measure is Dr. Bruce Switzer. Dr. Switzer has more than 30 years of experience in the metals and mining industry. Since 1975, he has worked on it as an executive and consultant addressing regulatory, socioeconomic, reclamation, environmental, and health matters and rising in the planning, development, planning, operation, and decommissioning of mines and mineral processing facilities. From 1990 to 1992, Dr. Switzer was Director of Environmental Affairs for Cominco Limited, where he had worldwide oversight responsibility for health and environmental regulatory compliance and legislative matters affecting the company. Much of his work for Cominco focused on oversight and evaluation of environmental aspects of Cominco's operations at its lead zinc mine in Alaska, lead and nickel smelters in British Columbia and Oregon, and startup of an open pit copper mine in Chile. Switzer holds a PhD in environmental studies from the University of Alberta. He currently lives in Tucson, Arizona, where he is a writer. He has much experience in the North as a laborer and professional. Switzer has extensively studied the plans for Pebble Mine and is the senior technical advisor for Alaskans for Clean Water, the group formed to promote passage of the Clean Water Initiative ballot measure number 4. Speaking in opposition to ballot measure number 4, which its opponents call the Mining Shutdown Initiative, is Lorna Shaw. Ms. Shaw is the executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers, a mining industry trade association composed of the large hard rock mining companies active in Alaska. A fourth-generation Alaskan with a graduate degree in business administration from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Ms. Shaw previously held government and community relations positions with Kinross Gold's Fort Knox mine in Fairbanks, and she has also served on the staff of Alaskan representatives in both the state legislature and the U.S. Senate. Ms. Shaw serves on the board of directors for the Resource Development Council and is past president of the Alaska Mining and Energy Resource Education Fund, AMREF. She lives in Fairbanks with her husband, Kelly, and her two-and-a-half-year-old daughter, Rachel. Okay, before we start with Dr. Switzer, here's a brief summary of what ballot measure 4 would do. And here is the actual language that will appear on the ballot next week. And that language reads as follows. This bill imposes two water quality standards on new large-scale metallic mining operations in Alaska. The first standard does not allow such a mining operation to release into water a toxic pollutant that will adversely affect human health or the life cycle of salmon. The second standard does not allow such a mining operation to store mining wastes and tailings that could release sulfuric acid, dissolved materials, or other toxic pollutants that could adversely affect water that is used by humans or by salmon. The bill defines a large-scale metallic mining operation to mean a metallic mining operation that is in excess of 640 acres in size. The bill defines toxic pollutants to include substances that will cause death and disease in humans and fish, and includes a list of substances identified as toxic pollutants under federal law, should this initiative become law. Now, millions of dollars have been spent by the supporters and opponents of this ballot measure, and it will help focus the discussion to touch briefly on the main topics in dispute. I'm going to say a very few things, and then Mr. Falls and Bill did, I'm going to talk as little as possible. I think it's important to note that supporters of ballot Measure 4 can focus on one proposed mine, the Pebble Project in southwest Alaska. Supporters of the ballot measure have asserted that the construction and operation of the Pebble Mine would harm the valuable Bristol Bay salmon runs, and supporters have contended that ballot measure number 4 is needed to prevent Pebble from going forward. Opponents, on the other hand, have focused on a particular provision of the full text of the law, which will not be on the ballot, but is printed in the State of Alaska voter guide sent to all voters, and there are copies outside the copies of the voter guide. And that provision, Section 2, states that the operative provision of the law, I mean, this provision of the law, which is Section, states the operative provision of the law, which is Section 2, and it reads just like this. Section 2 of this Act does not apply to existing large-scale metallic mineral mining operations that received all required federal, state, and local permits, authorizations, licenses, and approvals on or before the effective date of this Act or to future operations of existing facilities at those sites. And that, which I've just quoted on the board in front of you, is the Section 3 of the full text of the proposed law, which would be enacted if Ballot Measure 4 passes. This is sometimes called the grandfather clause, and opponents have raised concerns about whether this so-called grandfather clause will protect existing mines or operations or expansions of existing mines. And finally, the arguments over the effects of this ballot measure are more general than that, and the voter guide also has a provision that touches on that. The State of Alaska's Department of Natural Resources has issued a statement of costs that is required by law and is also put in the voter guide, and it reads like this. And that statement of costs includes a sentence that says, this initiative appears to propose language that does not differ significantly from existing water quality standards. Now, with that brief outlining of some of the areas that are in dispute, we turn now to Dr. Switzer, who will give an opening statement of no more than 4 minutes. Dr. Switzer?
Well, thank you all for coming here, and I hope you learn something when we're finished here. You know, this ballot initiative is about the Pebble Mine. It started with the Pebble Mine, and as far as we're concerned, it's about the Pebble Mine. I'm going to address the concerns that I hope through the question and answer period that some of you have regarding how it might affect other mines. But it is about the Pebble Mine, and it started with three guys in Bristol Bay. The initiative went through several iterations before we arrived at the place we are. The initiative has been reviewed by the Attorney General. He found it constitutional. The Superior Court found it constitutional, and so did the Supreme Court find that it was a constitutional initiative to put before the people. And I think Judge Blankenship, at the end of his finding, concluded that, and I think this best describes the intent of the ballot measure, and he says it that adversely affects salmon life cycle is appropriate to convey the obvious intent of the initiative. And, you know, the Pebble Mine is in a situation unlike any other mine in the world. There has never been a mine that is a sulfide mine that generates acid mine drainage that has been constructed in an environment which is as ecologically sensitive and economically important as Bristol Bay. Every mine that remotely resembles the Pebble proposal has contaminated the surrounding waters. And in my travels around Alaska and talking with people from the shutdown group, I could spend the rest of the evening talking about the mines that are similar to the Pebble Mine that have contaminated the environment. and they have yet to produce a single example of one that has not. And basically, what this initiative does is it takes away the mixing zone loophole that Murkowski gave them three or four years ago. It was something the mining industry lobbied for very, very vigorously. It was something Murkowski gave them. This would remove that regulation that they currently have. A mixing zone is the point where you, in a stream or river, where you discharge mine waste in excess of established water quality standards to the point downstream where it's sufficiently diluted that it would meet water quality standards. Well, in a salmon stream, there can be eggs and little salmon, and it has a very significant impact. Then, as far as pebble is concerned, again, it will destroy extremely large areas of salmon-spawning streams and use water from the remainder. It's over an earthquake zone. And so we think that it is just the wrong development in the wrong place. And I just want to leave you with this notion. You know, as with things individual and collective, there are times when it is times and places where something is appropriate here, and that same thing is inappropriate over here. And we're not against mining, and I think, as I'll explain, we're not going to shut down any mines. And I look forward to responding to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Switzer. Ms. Shaw, could you give an opening statement of up to 4 minutes?
Yes, please. I want to thank everybody first for coming out tonight. I know it's a school night, the first one of the year. So thanks to everybody for staying up a little bit late. And I also want to thank the folks who put this together tonight, because I think this is a very educational opportunity for Alaskan voters. And I appreciate the folks who debated before us. I learned a lot. I had some of my questions answered. So thank you for helping this Alaskan voter figure out what to do. What you've heard from Dr. Switzer and what you've heard really for the last several months is that this initiative is about pebble, and it's not. And that's one of the things that I'm looking forward to dispelling tonight. You know, they've spent millions of dollars to tell you that this is about pebble, but nowhere in the initiative do the words pebble or Bristol Bay appear. And there's a good reason for that. They can't. It's not constitutional to write a law about one specific project in one specific part of the state. You can't do that. And so when the Supreme Court affirmed that Measure 4 could appear on the ballot, what they said is, you know, Measure 4 is constitutional, it's legal. By being constitutional, it cannot be about a single mine. That's just, those are the facts. If it's legal, it's about mining in Alaska. They might also tell you it's about clean water. Is there anybody here that doesn't want clean water? I've spoken all over the state, and nobody has ever raised their hand about that. Again, fourth-generation Alaskan. I'm raising my daughter, fifth-generation Alaskan, up in Fairbanks. I want clean water for her, and I want clean water for me. That's not what this is about. If it were clean water, it would apply to all users of water resources. And it doesn't. My concern, and the reason I'm here today, the reason I've been participating in this for the last 7 months or so, is because the mining industry is very concerned about the uncertainty of this measure. You know, they tell you it's clear, and it's short. It's 4 pages, double-spaced. But it's not clear. What does it mean? We had to go through the Lieutenant Governor's office. We got an Attorney General's opinion. There's a differing opinion from the Legislative Legal Department. We had Superior Court Judge Teresi, Superior Court Judge Blankenship that went all the way to the Supreme Court. They've got their lawyers. We've got our lawyers. What the heck does this mean? So what I'm hoping to do today is help voters try to sort that out. We have had some exciting developments just this last week. 2 days ago, the state, the Palin administration, held a press conference, put together a website. DNR, DEC worked on that very hard. And I think the final product is good. If you have questions about the initiative and you don't want to hear from me or from Bruce, go look at the website. The state has laid out a lot of the facts. And you'll see that a lot of what they say is that the regulations are already in place. Alaska already does an outstanding job of protecting fish and protecting humans. It's already in place. And earlier today, this afternoon, Governor Palin herself took off her governor's hat for a moment and told us how she is going to vote. And she's voting no. Governor Palin, whose family fishes in Bristol Bay, thinks this is bad policy for Alaska. There's a lot of confusion. I hope that we can clear that up. I see that there's already a stack of questions. So I'm eager to try to help make sense of this for the voters of Alaska.
Thanks a lot, Ms. Shaw. Now, Dr. Switzer and Ms. Shaw will question each other. Roundels will be the same as we had in the previous discussion. Just briefly to review, each question can be up to 45 seconds in length. The person questioning gets up to 2.5 minutes to answer. Then there's an opportunity to rebut or comment on the answer for more than 45 seconds. We're going to have at least two questions. We might have more, although so far we have a whole bunch of questions from the audience. Once again, see Kari Gardy walking there and Kevin Waring over there. If you have questions, please write it out in 3x5 card, which they'll hand to you, and we'll get it going. Dr. Switzer, could you please pose your first question to Ms. Shaw?
Yeah, sure. Lorna, does Pebble or the other mines in Alaska need to discharge toxic mine waste into salmon spawning streams? And if they don't, and if they're not going to, why is there concern over a regulation that would say they cannot?
Mines in Alaska cannot discharge toxic waste. If they're going to discharge something that's going to harm fish, it's not going to be permitted. It's not allowed under the current regulations that we have today. I can't tell you what the plans for Pebble are other than to say, I can't believe that they would try to build and permit a mine that couldn't be permitted under the system that we have today. Again, you're making this about Pebble, but it is part of a larger picture. The mining industry in Alaska, I think, has a very good record. If you look at the fish populations in the areas that we have mines today, Fort Knox has a grayling population where there really wasn't anything like that before. One of the best sources of grayling in interior Alaska. And if you look at Red Dog, they now have fish in a stream that did not have fish prior to mining. I think that Alaska's mining industry is going to try to continue in that vein to do responsible resource development and protect Alaska's fish.
Dr. Switzer, do you have a comment or response or both? Mm-hmm.
Well, that wasn't responsive to my question. I said if you are cleaning up the water everywhere and, in fact, improving it, and if you're meeting all of the standards and you don't need to discharge into salmon spawning streams, then why would you oppose a regulation that says you cannot do what you say you're already not doing?
Well, I guess if you're referring to Measure 4, I'd say because it's not clear that that's what Measure 4 says. Measure 4 is ambiguous. Measure 4 is vague. And what Measure 4 is actually going to bring to the mining industry is really a big question. We don't know what regulations are going to come from that. And actually, if you go to the state's website that they just put up, they do have a message on there that says the ballot measure's language is general and less precise than the language used in current federal and state law. If you're concerned about fish and salmon, they're already, if you're concerned about salmon and people, they're already protected under more stringent laws. Why would you write a law that wasn't even as good?
Michaud, would you like to make that your second question? Your first question?
Actually, I wouldn't like to use that one.
Okay. Why don't we go now with your first question?
It actually does stem from that. You know, the state constitution says that you cannot legislate against a specific project in Alaska. If you write a law, it has to apply to an industry. The Supreme Court, when they ruled that ballot measure 4 was legal and could appear on the ballot, affirmed that Measure 4 could not be about one specific mine. DNR and DEC have come out with their website, and the language on their website says that existing mines will likely need changes to their permits to accommodate future changes in their operations. Future changes would fall under the initiative. Governor Palin herself has said that this is bad policy. How can you continue to assert that this is just about Pebble?
Well, it's about Pebble because that's where it started, and it is the intention of the ballot measure that it would put some roadblocks in the way. No one is sufficiently delusional to think it would stop Pebble in its tracks, but It would send a very powerful message to the legislators. There are three bills. There have been three bills, two House bills and a Senate bill, as well as another House bill to create a reserve, no mining zone in Bristol Bay. They have all stalled in the House and the Senate. They haven't got out of committee. In fact, there's one languishing right now. It's, HB 74. It's proposed by Seaton, and the chairman is holding it up. It would roll back the mixing zone regulation that Murkowski gave the mining industry. We felt that it would be the first step in the way to blocking the or stopping the Pebble project, and it does not stop mining in Alaska. And I will explore that later. But you probably noticed that Mrs. Shaw didn't answer my first question, and. You know, the Alaska Constitution, the constitutional debate is preserved word by word. And on day 39 through 42, they talked about the initiative process. And they used as an example for an initiative the banning of fish traps in Washington State and Oregon through the initiative process. So very clearly they had in mind a conservation measure just like the one we are taking. And if you read the initiative, and while the grammar is not Hemingway-esque in its brevity, if you read that, the two operative clauses refer to salmon spawning and mine waste into salmon spawning streams. And regardless of the legal action that went on and didn't go on, and both sides confused the issue in court, Judge Blankenship made it very clear that the intent of this ballot measure was to prevent the discharge of toxic mine waste into salmon spawning streams. And that was the first question I asked, and I have yet to get an answer out of the Alaskans Against the Mining Shutdown for that question.
Interesting that you mentioned that nobody's delusional enough to say that this stops Pebble, but I think I've seen a number of ads over the last several months that say this stops Pebble. And for this to have begun with Pebble, you know, and that was the premise and that's what you mean for it to be is one thing. But the black and white on the paper is what Alaskan voters are casting their ballots on. And the black and white on the paper is not about Pebble. The black and white on the paper is about the mining industry in Alaska.
So I think we're now on to the next question here.
Okay, yeah. In my travels, I had expected to see a mining engineer standing up here explaining why this would stop mining. But I'll ask Lorna this hypothetical anyways. Let's assume that ballot measure number 4 passes and the mining industry cannot discharge mine waste into salmon spawning streams below the current EPA standard. How does that prevent you from building stable dumps in lifts set back from salmon spawning streams so that you can construct a diversion ditch that's properly lined and directed into a water treatment plant that's adequately designed and that works? How does it stop you from building other water control structures that keep mine waste out of salmon spawning streams?
I'm not going to apologize for not being an engineer. I will tell you that I am a fourth generation Alaskan, though, and I've worked in the mining industry, and I'm in my home. You may have expected a mining engineer, but I don't know what it was that you read. I've been going to come to this forum since it was planned. When it comes to how does this stop, that's the big question. We don't know. There's a simple answer to a lot of the questions that Dr. Switzer is asking. We don't know what is going to come of this initiative. The regulations have not been written. Right here. These are the regs. Page after page. We don't know. They have yet to be written. And so when you're asking us to tell you exactly how this is going to stop, you tell me exactly how is this going to stop? Exactly how is this going to do anything? You don't know. It's not written.
Well, if it's going to stop mining, you know, I have an 11-year-old daughter. When I say, look, you can't do this because this is going to happen, you'll get hurt or something, she says, why or how? And that's a question I've been asking. How does this shut them? How does this prevent them from operating their equipment? There are all kinds of methodologies and technologies that I've employed myself in controlling mine waste that can be employed to protect salmon streams. And what is it about this ballot measure that would result in a prohibition of discharge of toxic mine waste into salmon streams that is going to prevent the mining industry from employing those methodologies and technologies? And I have yet to hear the answer to that. They won't explain why it prevents the construction of stable dumps or diversion ditches that actually are lined and properly sized, or how it prevents them from designing and constructing and operating a water treatment plant that discharges water that meets established, long-established water quality standards. No one has been able to tell me about that, just like no one has produced an example of a mine like Pebble which has not contaminated the water around it.
Although that we've had several questions back and forth to each other, I think now that's the time for a second question from Ms. Shaw. Ms. Shaw.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's Ms. Shaw's turn, I think, is it
yes.
not?
The question I have is, we hear Bruce talk about mixing zones. He was quoted in the Peninsula Clarion as saying that Alaska's permitting process is just a rubber stamp. It's about dotting I's and crossing T's, and that the mining companies get what they want. My question is, Bruce, have you ever permitted a mine in Alaska?
Yes, I have.
Please tell me more about that.
Tell you more about the permitting process?
No, your experiences.
Beg pardon?
Your experiences permitting a mine in Alaska. Which mine?
Well, the mines I've been involved with in Alaska were pre-Murkowski. I have not had any experience since the rollback in environmental regulations. And the mine I was involved in permitting has been in non-compliance with its water quality permit for 20 years. First 10 years with acid mine drainage that resulted in millions of dollars in fines and ordered remedial work. The last 10 years they've been in non-compliance and fined for total dissolved solids problems. They've been fined over air emissions, failing to report and failing to monitor air emissions, oil spills, lead zinc spills, and so my experience permitting mines in Alaska was probably the reason that I decided I didn't want to work in the mining industry anymore. And the reality is that we can look at every mine in Alaska or elsewhere, but particularly in Alaska, and we'll find a lot of non-compliance. And big mines make a big mess, and they have a tough time. And some of them try hard. Some don't try as hard as others. But they have problems. They have accidents. And unanticipated things happen when they get into the dirt. Intercept, as they did at the mine I'm referring to, they had not conducted hydrogeological studies, and they intercepted an aquifer that was loaded with acid mine drainage that went straight into a stream and hence into a river about 30 miles away that resulted in two big fish kills that resulted in a nearly $5 million fine and ordered remedial work. They didn't berm their oil storage tanks and on the coast, even though there were three orders to berm them, one from the fire marshal, one from the Coast Guard, one from the EPA, and they didn't berm their oil storage tanks, and then they had an accident, and there was a big fine. So not only have I had experience permitting, but I've had experience auditing the permitting status of mines in Alaska.
Sounds an awful lot like perhaps you have some experience in poor management. I can't believe that your permitting experience in Alaska was easy, and I find it very interesting that the mine that you're referring to is actually a very good success story for Alaska. So,
Well, the information that I just passed on to you is no secret. It's all recorded in EPA documents. In fact, everything I'll have to say to you this evening is documentable, and if anyone is curious after where the information comes from, I'd be perfectly happy to provide it.
And now we're going to go to audience questions. I have quite a thick stack. We'll do the best we can to get through as many as we can. And I think the first question, I think it's for both of you, but it would start out with you, Dr. Switzer. If the Department of Natural Resources statement is accurate, why is there all this effort to pass an initiative that, quote, that does not differ significantly from existing water quality standards?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. First of all, the DNR document, Ed Fogles, who is one of the senior people in the DNR, told us that he had been under great pressure from the mining industry to produce that document. The document they have produced is virtually identical to the documents and the slideshows that I have seen around the state put on by the Alaskans against the mining shutdown. And quite frankly, I think it is a serious abuse of bureaucratic authority and power to take a position in a ballot initiative like this, kind of almost presuming, as Ms. Shaw does, that the voters here are too dumb to figure their way through what's going on here. And to see bureaucrats essentially shilling for the mining industry was extremely disappointing. But as I say, the document that they have produced is virtually identical to the document, the PowerPoint presentation and other documentation, that even the slides are the same in the government or the DNR presentation to the ones that the Alaskans against the mining shutdown have been putting on around town.
I will say that the DNR DEC website was welcome by the Alaskans against the mining shutdown, but we absolutely had zero input putting that together. There was not pressure, and so I take great offense at that. We are not telling our regulators what to do. They are independent. Separately, the slides that you have seen in the AAMS presentation that you have seen on the DNR website are there because the DNR has done an excellent job with a slideshow presentation that they've given for quite some time all around the state explaining the permitting process. Some of their slides were outstanding and do the best job explaining the permitting process that we have in place. And so the Alaskans Against the Mining Shutdown decided not to reinvent the wheel, but we are actually using slides from the DNR's website to explain Alaska's rigorous permitting process, a process that's been in place. It's evolved over 30 years. It was developed by Alaskans for Alaska, and there are absolutely similarities because we're talking about the same process.
I think this question is for both of you, but I think I would start with you, Ms. Shaw. All mines similar to Pebble Mine that have existed in the past have polluted their surrounding waters. What kind of promise can Pebble give to Alaska so that our waters will not be polluted?
You know, I think it's really interesting because most of the time when you're hearing about these mines like Pebble everywhere that pollute, first of all, we're not talking about Alaska. These are not mines that have been or possibly even could be permitted in Alaska. And in most cases, we're not talking about mining today. I mean, to some degree, that's like talking about, you know, the medicine that was practiced 50 or 100 years ago. Let me tell you, that's not the same medicine that's practiced today. You can't go in and get a lobotomy. It is not the same thing. And so often when you're shown pictures of you know, bad mining practices, you're shown pictures from the 40s and the 50s, and I will tell you that they are all from outside of Alaska. Alaska has a permitting process in place that works. It's one of the most rigorous in the world. And I absolutely don't think that you're going to see that here. If there is enough risk, it's not going to be permitted. If it's going to hurt the fish population, it will not be permitted. But again, that's taking a concern about a single mine in Alaska that isn't addressed by this initiative.
The previous question, I didn't answer that completely. I was asked, or we were asked, about the DNR site, and one of the things they have said on that is that this ballot initiative changes nothing. In fact, at the press conference the DNR held, a reporter asked, I think it was Ed Fogles, asked him if this ballot measure will change anything, and he said no. And he looked at one of his assistants. I don't know, they may be sitting here tonight, in fact. And he said, how about that? And she said, well, it might change a word or two. So if this doesn't change anything, and they're protecting everything, and they're even making the water better everywhere, why are they opposing a rule-making process that would simply say you can't do what you already say you're doing? As far as mines worldwide and these being ancient history, that's flat-out wrong. Grassberg, Summitville, Mark Hopper, OK Teddy, these are all, and I could carry on for the rest of the evening talking about these specific mines that were acid-generating heavy metals that have polluted the surrounding water, and they're not ancient history. They're current, operating, existing. You can go to the sites. The EPA has estimated that 40% of the headwaters in Western America are contaminated with acid mine waste. There are approximately $20 billion worth of Superfund sites around America as a consequence of the mining industry. The fact of the matter is, Pebble is an unminable situation. If Pebble were plunked down where Red Dog is, I wouldn't be here. It doesn't have the hydrogeological problems. It doesn't have the hydrology problems. It's not on top of an earthquake zone. There isn't an exquisitely sensitive environment around it. It's just out there in the tundra, and they could build Pebble there if they wanted, but not in Bristol Bay. There's no way they can build that mine there without contaminating the surrounding water bodies. And on top of that, they're going to destroy substantial portions just in the mine, the physical mine process. And if that isn't enough, it's on top of an earthquake zone that the USGS predicts will have a quake of magnitude equivalent to the Denali quake sooner or later. And it's going to have the biggest tailings dam, and sooner or later the ground is going to shake and that
Bruce
tailings dam
is going.
Bruce is
talking about Pebble again. We're talking about the initiative tonight. We're talking about the initiative. We are not here to have a debate about Pebble. And as for the DNR's website, it says the actual language is that the ballot measure's language is general and less precise than the language used in current federal state law. It also goes on to say the initiative's imprecise terminology leaves room for differing interpretations that will likely have to be resolved by the courts. That's what we're concerned about. That's the uncertainty. That's the concern of the mining industry.
And I know we'll get back to Pebble. I'd like to go to another question about effects on other mines in Alaska. And I think we'd start with you, Dr. Switzer, on this. I do think Ms. Shaw can also respond afterwards. Dr. Switzer, how can you argue against the state of Alaska when, as the state has said, that this proposed initiative will affect all existing major mines and not just the Pebble project in terms of language they have talked about expansions or other mines? Expansive existing mines or other mines in Alaska?
Well, I mentioned earlier the operative clause in a phrase in this is salmon spawning streams. The nearest salmon spawning stream to the Red Dog expansion is approximately 20 miles away at the nearest point. And I mentioned earlier there are all kinds of methodologies and technologies they can employ to protect the streams in the immediate vicinity of the mine site, let alone a salmon stream that's many miles away. Similarly, for all of the other existing mine, these technologies are no secret. You know, building stable dumps and lifts, diversion ditches at work, properly sized water treatment plant. There's no secret to that. What happens is the environment just does not get enough attention, and it's not unique to Alaska. It's a characteristic of the mining industry generally. Some do a pretty nice job. Some don't do such a good job. The record on Red Dog is clear. They have been under a compliance by consent order virtually since they set foot on the property over 20 years ago. It resulted in, as I mentioned earlier, two very big clean water actions. And so to say that you know, we're just squeaky clean, we're not harming the environment, that was my question. Why, if they're not contaminating water bodies in the vicinities of their properties, and why, if they're not having water management problems, and indeed if they're even making the water purer than it was before, what's the problem with this measure? The fact of the matter is that the story about their record is a fiction. You know, we need mining. Don't mistake me. We're not against mining. I'm not against mining. Mining was good to me. But let's not fool ourselves. And on a project like Pebble, it's a looming disaster. And Ms. Shaw says, well, let's talk about the initiative. Well, she won't talk about mining. She won't talk about the regulatory process. They want to say that this is vague and mysterious and there's going to be legal action down the road. And gosh, that's so scary. Well, you know, read the Constitutional Convention. And the guys who wrote it were just like people like us. And in several places there, they said, look, the Alaska voters are smart enough to figure their way through the initiative, whatever it happens to be that's put in front of them. A lot of the legislators opposed the initiative process for the very same reasons that I'm hearing here, that people are just too dumb to figure this whole thing out. And I don't personally believe that, but I don't think we're so dumb as to believe cake on the frosting, sort of frosting on the cake story.
Alaska has a great record of mining history. If you look at Red Dog, there are fish in a stream at Red Dog where there have been no fish before. Mother Nature didn't allow for fish in the area where Red Dog is, and there are now fish where they weren't. If you look at Fort Knox, there was historic mine cuts that were cleaned up as part of the concurrent reclamation that is now an amazing source of grayling for interior Alaska. If you look at Greens Creek is probably the best example worldwide of how mining can coexist with environmental protection. Greens Creek is located on in Tongass National Forest on Admiralty Island, which is a national treasure. If they didn't do it right, they wouldn't be there. Mining and the environmental protection and fish protection can and do coexist. What we're saying is that we have laws in place today. We understand what they are. We work to comply with those laws. This initiative brings something new. We don't know exactly what that is. We don't know. And so for us to say that, yes, we can absolutely comply with it, that's foolish. We don't know. So I'm absolutely going to continue touting uncertainty because that's the biggest issue with this measure. It's short. It's 4 pages. It's double-spaced. 3 guys wrote it. There wasn't a process where the mining industry had a seat at the table, the general public had a seat at the table. People could make changes to this. It's an up or down vote. The good news is we get to vote. But it's an up or down vote. This is not the way to make scientific policy in Alaska. This is a bad move.
I'd like to move on to another question here. Should we also vote, Ms. Shaw, one of the people asks, should we also vote against ballot measures 1, 2, and 3 because the regulations haven't yet been written?
I'm not an expert on the other measures, but I think you absolutely need to read those measures, figure out what goes into them, and whether or not it's a good idea. This measure is about science. These are scientific standards that are not yet set. We don't know what they are. Bad idea.
Dr. Switzer, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I wish Ms. Shaw would read the Constitutional Convention and get over this notion that people are too stupid to figure their way through things. You know, this was the discussion is really marvelous in that. And they realized that if the legislature was not doing something that some citizens felt they should be doing, they had the right to take action. And they debated this at great length. And there is no provision for going out and asking the people who you are, you know, whatever the initiative is, you're going to ask the people who might be affected by it or the people who don't like it to say, well, do you like this initiative? No, it's the citizens who put that together. And we got 33,000 signatures. And it's a ballot initiative. And we had no intention of talking to the mining industry about this ballot initiative. Why should we? We oppose the Pebble project. Should we have gone to Northern Dynasty and said, what do you guys think about this? You know? If anyone is confused, you know, you have several ballot initiatives, and my wife is a constitutional and legislative attorney, and she read it for me, but she said, here it is, and you read it, and so I did, and I've now read it two or three times, and there's some brilliant stuff in there, particularly a legislator by the name of Colonel Marston, and at one point, people just like Lorna would say, oh, it's too hard, you know, and he said, look, the people of Alaska are smart enough to figure their way through this, and they have a right to put an initiative on the table. And if the other side doesn't like it, well, that's too bad. It's highly unlikely that they would like it.
You know, it's on the table, but it's already gone through several court battles. We still don't have the final details, and this is just a bad, bad way to do it. We have a policy in place. We know what that policy is. And to keep pushing this and saying, oh, gee, it's no different, yet it's going to stop Pebble, come on.
Let's talk about, here's another question that going back to Pebble itself, and we're going to start with Dr. Switzer on this. Dr. Switzer, could you please give us specific examples as to why the state environmental standards are going to work or not work appropriately with Pebble, and that must mean the current standards?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is not unique to Alaska. Just a little background. I lectured for a period of time at one of the major universities fairly recently, and it was a graduate program, and the portions of the course I did were on the regulatory review process, and I compared and contrasted different regulatory review processes. And, you know, in the case of Alaska, as far as the review process is concerned, after the Murkowski changes, the Alaska Miners Association's executive director referred to the Murkowski rollbacks as massive. The Fraser Institute, which is an arch-conservative pro-mining think tank, every year consults mining company executives and asks them to rate various jurisdictions regarding their thoughts on taxes and environmental regulations. And in 2007, these mining company executives rated 117 states, provinces, and countries based on low taxes and ease of environmental regulations. In this process, a few years ago, Alaska used to be kind of solidly in the upper middle. Today, Alaska is the 10th easiest, according to the Fraser Institute, the 10th most friendly jurisdiction for mining in the world, with only one other state as friendly to mining as Alaska, and that's Nevada. And this is not my opinion. This is straight out of the Fraser Institute and the Alaska Miners Association. And so the previous regulations, while they would have made it more difficult on Pebble, the fact is that in Alaska, once a mining company starts applying for permits, if they cross the I's and dot the T's, they get approval for a variety of reasons that I'm not going to go in here. Ms. Shaw is shaking her head, and identify one mine virtually anywhere that has been rejected as unsuitable based on the permits, not on markets or the Federal Clean Water Act, but on the basis of the Alaska permitting process, what mine has ever been turned down?
First, I want to address the mixing zone issue. Have you read the regulations? I cannot believe that you have, because the regulations in place today dealing with mixing zones already prohibit mixing zones in salmon spawning grounds, and the changes that were made in the Murkowski era administration actually strengthened those mixing zones. And what they did is they effectively prohibited spawning areas, mixing zones and spawning areas and rearing areas, or areas that could be used as spawning or rearing areas in the future. Those regulations were adopted by DEC. They've actually never been implemented. They weren't approved by the EPA. So we are still permitting mines today under the previous administration's regulations. If you were a mining expert in Alaska, you would know that. If you permitted mines here in Alaska today, you would know that.
Ms. Shaw, that's flat out false.
No.
Read Representative Seaton's House Bill 74, and which is languishing right now
in the House,
and it. The purpose of that bill is to roll back the mixing zone loophole. And on his webpage, there is a chart which compares the regulations prior to Murkowski, the regulations that Murkowski adopted, and what HB 74 would do by way of clawing back to the pre-Murkowski mixing zone situation, which was prohibited.
Wrong. That is wrong. Today, we have more stringent laws in place, but we're still being permitted under the old regulations. Besides that, mixing zones aren't addressed in this measure.
Let's go to another topic, Dr. Switzer. And the question is, I'm curious with the very ambiguous description of the size of mine, quote, in excess of 640 acres, unquote, and what the real definition is. Does the definition refer to disturbed acres, continuous acres, patented land, cumulative land position? This definition is key and central to the ballot measure.
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't write this. And as I said earlier, it's not an example of the most brilliant language. And that's one part of it that is not. And there are two operating minds right now that we think would fit within that definition of being less than 640 acres. And it would be the actual physical mine as defined by the dumps, the physical facilities, and so on. It wouldn't include the access road in, for example, or if it's an underground mine and one of the workings extended out, it would not include that. It would mean the surface, the workings on the surface that are associated with the mine. And this is the intent. And, you know, one of the things you need to remember in the constitutional debate, the founders gave the legislature the authority to amend an initiative because they recognized that it might not have it might suffer from some clarity or ambiguity, and so they have the authority to amend it, provided they maintain the original intent of it. And that was the primary purpose, I think, and lawyers that I know agree with that, of Judge Blankenship's identification at the end of his ruling, where he identified the intent of the ballot measure, which, as I say, was adversely affect salmon life cycle is appropriate to convey the intent of the initiative.
Michelle, do you have a...
I do.
Comment?
You know, Judge Blankenship said that it conveys the intent, but he doesn't define what the intent is. Obviously, you know, the proponents continue to say it's pebble, it's pebble, it's pebble. The intent is to limit the mining industry in Alaska and make it tougher for them to do business in Alaska. That's what this does. And you know, Bruce continues to talk about how, you know, Alaskan voters are smart, and I will not take anything away from Alaskan voters. They absolutely are smart people, have the opportunity to make a decision on this, and an informed decision, and I appreciate everyone here tonight trying to learn more about the initiative. But even the Supreme Court judges said in their deliberations that, you know, it's taken us 4 hours to figure out whether or not it's even legal. How do we expect the voters to figure this out? That was a question. That was part of the deliberations in the Supreme Court. This is confusing. This isn't just confusing for the average voter. This is confusing for lawyers. We've got lawyers all across the board that say it means all kinds of different things. It's part of the problem. How do you know what to think? It's very, very deceptive and confusing.
I think that some of the other questions will get at that some more, and I'd like to get at them, and I'd like to start with you on this next one, Dr. Switzer. Because the exact standards aren't defined within the initiative, isn't it possible that they may be less stringent than current regulations?
Well, an initiative wouldn't define standards, just as no act or bill defines standards. There's a rulemaking procedure following the adoption of an act. where the standards are established. Federal law precludes a state from a state can adopt their own standard, environmental standards under federal law, provided they are equal to or better than the EPA standards. So in the case of water quality, any standards adopted would be the equal of the, you know, the longstanding EPA water quality standards. And so, no, there is not a danger of those of that happening. The EPA could step in and say, no, you can't adopt those water quality standards.
Ms. Shaw, do you have a comment on that?
For once, I agree that, I mean, they wouldn't loosen the standards. They would say that the existing standards were adequate if that were the case. They wouldn't make them less. They wouldn't take away from what we already have.
Ms. Shaw, this is a question for you. You have said that Alaska has strict laws and cannot discharge toxic waste. As a Bristol Bay fisherman who has studied this issue for years, I have read the laws. The laws say that you have to mitigate, prevent, or compensate for activities that may impact clean water. Why won't the mining industry acknowledge this language, and how can you compensate for clean water in the fisheries it supports in Bristol Bay?
We cannot discharge toxic waste into an area that's going to harm fish. The existing law right now that this is part of the administrative code says that there may be no concentrations of toxic substances in water or in shoreline or bottom sediments that singly or in combination cause or reasonably can be expected to cause adverse effects on aquatic life or produce undesirable or nuisance aquatic life except as authorized by this chapter. That's what we're already held to. We cannot discharge in an amount that's going to, scientifically set, that's going to hurt aquatic life. That's there today.
Dr. Fisher, do you have a comment on that?
Well, the fact of the matter is that you probably heard the last clause of that, except as authorized by this statute. And if you refer to it elsewhere, there are all kinds of loopholes. If you want to read about the mixing zones that I'm talking about, read 18 AAC 70.24. That is the current law that allows mixing zones that Murkowski passed. I have it in my briefcase if anyone would like to look at it. And it is legal, it is perfectly legal to have in Alaska right now to have a mixing zone in a salmon spawning stream. You are prohibited during the period of time when the spawning salmon are there. But when the salmon's on its way to spawn, they'll swim through a brick wall after and then they die. The critical time is after the eggs are laid, and then when the little salmon come out, that's when they are the most sensitive to mine waste, and during that period of time, it's perfectly legal to have a mixing zone in that stream. And HB 74 would pull that back, and so would this ballot measure.
There are no loopholes when it comes to mixing zones. There are none. The regulations as they stand today prohibit mixing zones in spawning areas and in rearing areas and areas that in the future could be spawning or rearing areas. That's the simple truth.
I want to go with you, Dr. Switzer, on this question. This audience member asked, what would be the worst thing that would occur if this initiative didn't pass? As you, Dr. Switzer, said, there's not much that changes if it is passed. And I think I'm going to read this last sentence. Wouldn't it just continue to fight to be allowed but denied over and over until it gives up?
Would you ask that question again?
The last part is, wouldn't it just continue to fight to be allowed but denied over and over until it gives up? And I think this goes back to the first part of the question, which is, what would be the worst thing that would happen if this initiative didn't pass?
Well, the fight will go on. And I presume it will go on one way or another. You know, the mining shutdown people keep talking about all this legal action. Well, you know, during the initiative process, all the legal action regarding the initiative was brought by the Pebble Partnership and the mining industry. We were going to bring action, but we didn't. Now, it's fair to say that we caused it by getting this ballot initiative approved, but the legal action that resulted from it came from the mining industry, and that's a matter of public record. As far as there being legal action, you know, I think about that sometimes, and I'm married to an attorney, you know, I'm kind of happy I live in a country and am a citizen of one where the citizens can resolve their issues legally and when they agree and disagree. And it seems to me that taking legal action is preferable to foreign mining companies destroying a salmon resource, you know? And, you know, on that subject, you know, APOC released the amount of money that's been spent on this issue yesterday. This is the third release. The Alaskans Against the Mining Shutdown has spent in excess of $10 billion, half of which has come from the Pebble Partnership, which means Anglo-American, this South African company. And about 90% of that money has come from foreign mining companies. The remaining 9% from a Utah company. We have spent a little in excess of $2 million. And as far as legal action, again, you know, if that's what it takes, then that's what we'll do.
Michelle, do you have a comment?
I do. I think that if this measure doesn't pass, then Alaska's mining industry can continue to grow. Right now it is the second largest to oil and gas. It's growing. These are 3,500 good jobs for hardworking Alaskans. This is the kind of industry we want in our state. These are Alaskans working at the mines all over the state. This isn't just an Anchorage issue. This is a statewide issue. But I'm glad that you brought up the funding. You know, we have spent a lot of money, and it hasn't come from one company. It has come from all of the different companies involved in mining in Alaska today. And it shows cooperation and concern among the entire industry, not just one issue. And we've also disclosed where every single dollar has come from. Not so of the other side. Bruce has even said that he's uncomfortable with the funding situation. And I would think that as the lead spokesperson for this organization, that he had some control over where this money comes from and why it's not disclosed. And I would think that he would work to stop that. Apparently, that has not been the case.
My title is technical advisor, and it's true, and let's cut to the chase right here. Americans for Job Security have contributed some money to us, and they are a 501c6 that is operating perfectly legally. I am uncomfortable with 501c6s. I haven't liked them since their inception. I didn't like them when I was working in Washington, and I don't like them here. However, I'll tell you what. I'll work with a group getting money from them before I'll work with a group who are getting most of their money from a South African company who have made most of their money on the bodies of dead miners.
I think it's interesting that the place where most of their funding comes from is the same guy who's invested both his own money and the state's money in this South African company. I mean, these companies that are funding our efforts are the same companies who are providing jobs for Alaskans. I mean, that's just like calling BP a foreign oil company.
It employs
2,000 Alaskans.
I'd like to move on now to more back into the questions on the initiative itself. Ms. Shaw, can you name one Alaska mine that is currently in complete compliance, and I assume that means with current environmental laws?
Fort Knox.
Is that one that, are you still associated with that mine?
I do some work for them.
Okay.
Yes.
Fort Knox is having serious problems with cyanide leaking from their tailings dam, according to the EPA. Greens Creek has been in violation of their clean water permit 400 times, and the list of violations at other mines goes on and on.
Fort Knox has a record that is the envy of many mines throughout the world. There was a seep in the tailings impoundment last year. This was actually a success story. It was discovered by employees at Fort Knox. It was reported that same day. It was investigated. The company worked to remedy that, and there was no release to the environment, period. It was a great success story, and they are in compliance, full compliance.
This next question goes back to one that we've talked a little bit about, but I think this goes a little bit further. In order to understand this ballot initiative, I feel that I would need to be an environmental scientist and/or natural resources law attorney. I am neither. Is it reasonable to expect Alaskans to vote knowledgeably on such a complex and on such complex and disputed matters? I think that would start with you, Dr. Switzer.
Well, you know, I don't think you need either. You know, one of the things you've heard earlier tonight, I asked Ms. Shaw very two specific questions about mining technology and regulations, and the answer to those questions always is the same thing. From whichever PR person that I'm dealing with, it's these things are very vague, we don't know what's going to happen, it's all very mysterious, and we're afraid of it. And this is the industry that lives through boom and bust. But, you know, in law, there's an old adage, and it goes, when the facts are on your side, argue the facts. When the law is on your side, argue the law. And when neither the facts nor the law are on your side, you pound the table and attack the man. And that is the approach that the mining shutdown people have taken. They have yet, as I said earlier, to produce a mining engineer to explain why this protection of salmon streams would prevent them, in most circumstances, from mining. How it prevents them from operating a water treatment plant, as they do on mines all over the place. How does it prevent them from doing adequate geologic and other studies necessary to manage for a good water management plan? And I have yet to hear an answer to that question because there isn't one, because they can do it. The basic problem with this is environmental regulation. And to a mining operator, the phrase environmental regulation gets the same result as gun control does to a gun nut. Their eyes cross, smoke comes out of their ears, and that's the end of the discussion.
Attack the man. I think it's actually attack the mine, or in this case, the project. These are the same people who are telling you, you know, that it's about Pebble, one mine again. They're telling you that, you know, they're going to build a dam bigger than the Space Needle. Where did the Space Needle come from? I mean, how does that relate to Measure 4? That is the fear-mongering that we're seeing in this campaign. We have the facts on our side. We don't know what this initiative is going to bring. That is absolute certainty for the mining industry that this could be a problem. We don't know. Very concerning to the industry. But for them to say, you know, vote yes, stop Pebble, what is that all about?
You know, and just one comment here. You know, if I were in the mining industry still today and I wanted to be afraid of something, I'd be worried about commodity prices right now. You know, the big driver on the Pebble project is copper, and there's kind of three stools. It was housing prices here. Copper was used for houses. And then the other big driver behind copper prices is electrical transmission in India and China. And you all know what's happened to the housing market here. There are a lot of analysts that think that the Chinese economy is overheated, and all this is going to take is a little drop in commodity prices. And in my career, I've seen gold at the equivalent of $2,400 and $200, copper at 60 cents and 360. And this project is, the Pebble project is marginal to begin with. So that's another thing that could very easily happen to it. Kamenko thought it was marginal, and but if I was in the mining, that's what I'd be afraid of, not the obligation to protect some salmon streams.
I want to ask you, Ms. Shaw, this question from an audience member. Do you think the existing laws for mining in Alaska will actually prevent an earthquake in Bristol Bay for the proposed Pebble mine and or toxic spilling that would occur as a result of the earthquake? And also, what would your response be if or when there is an earthquake in the Bristol Bay area that causes a spill at Pebble Mine?
I have to believe the first half of that was a joke. Mining in Alaska is regulated. The mining permitting process in Alaska is difficult. It is not, as Dr. Switzer says, a rubber stamp. It is not going in and just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. It's not like getting your driver's license. You don't go take a multiple test multiple choice test in Parallel Park and walk out and say, you know, I've got my mine license. It is a very, very lengthy process. And earthquakes are part of the planning process for a mine. If it cannot be planned, built, permitted to withstand whatever size earthquake is called for in that area, I think it's a level 3 zone, it's not going to be permitted. If that is a true risk, that cannot be planned for, the mine won't be permitted. But what does this measure do about earthquakes?
Well, it would stop the construction of a mine over top of one. That's what it would do.
No more than existing regulations today.
When you read the review, the literature and experience on tailings dam failures, there have been several earthen dams. In the last few years, there's been a lot of earthen dams that have failed as a consequence of either earthquake and or excess precipitation. One recently in Romania, designed incidentally by the same engineering firm that's designing the tailings dam at Pebble. It failed when there was excess moisture that overtopped it, and it leaked toxic mine waste into the Danube River and wiped out the Danube River for miles.
You're leaving out some important facts.
And that was just a couple of years ago.
KP did design that dam, but the dam was not maintained and operated to the specifications that the engineers who designed it said that it needed to be. They didn't follow the direction of the folks who designed the dam. So you can't blame the engineers for failure to maintain and operate properly.
According to the European Task Force report, the European Task Force of engineers and consultants that investigated that dam failure, one of the factors that they said was contributory to this disaster was tailings dam design. Now, maybe they're wrong, maybe the engineers are right, I don't know, but it failed. And the same at OK Teddy, which resulted in monumental disaster. An earthquake took out tailings dam, and because it was in the third world,
none of these have been permitted in Alaska.
Well, these are the same companies, Lorna, operating in Alaska. Rio Tinto, for example. These are transnational mining companies, and the way they operate elsewhere is the way they would operate here if they could.
If they're going to operate
in
Alaska, they will operate to Alaska's standards, or they won't operate in Alaska. It's that simple.
Okay. I guess there's another question here that relates to several things we've talked about, and I'm trying to ask it to get at this a different way. What specifically in ballot measure 4, if it passes, would change existing law as compared to existing law, would prevent the operation and construction of Pebble Mine or any other particular project? What specifically, given what the state has said, the Department of Natural Resources has said, would make a difference if ballot measure 4 passes?
Ballot measure number 4 was a prohibition on the destruction of salmon habitat or the discharge of mine waste into salmon habitat would make it more difficult for Pebble.
Those are already provided for in existing law.
And as far as existing law is concerned, if the legislature acts on it, it would roll back 18 AAC 70.240 as per Mr. Makowski. That's what it would do, among other things, and it could, as I say, the legislature would have a look at this. Then it goes into a rulemaking process. It's not very complicated. What these folks have done is make it complicated because they can't answer the real questions that we ask, like how does it physically affect the mining process. They won't answer those questions, so they make up this confusion. It's very confusing. We don't understand it. Nobody can understand it. And these terrible legislators in Alaska are going to shut down mining if they get their hands on this ballot measure.
I don't think we've ever said anything like that. We have absolutely said it's a confusing measure, and I will maintain that it is a confusing measure. We don't know what the courts are going to do. The confusion isn't made up. It's real. If you read that measure, explain to me exactly clearly how, what it does. It's very difficult. We've got attorneys on one hand who say it does one thing. The other end of the spectrum is right over here, and we've got attorneys that say that. These are trained attorneys. Again, those Supreme Court judges talked about it and said it took us 4 hours to figure out whether it's even legal. How are the voters going to figure this one out? And I am not discounting the intelligence of Alaska's voters, but I am saying that this is a very poorly crafted measure. I mean, Dr. Switzer himself has said that this is a blunt instrument where a scalpel would have been better. Why not perfect your product and bring it back to Alaskan voters?
Dr. Switzer, the Kennecott mine at McCarthy was at a headwater of the Salmon Ridge Copper River, as this audience member asked.
Which one are we talking about?
The Kennecott mine in McCarthy is what this audience member asserts. Was at a headwater of the Salmon Ridge Copper River. Would this initiative have stopped that mine if it was law back then?
You know, that mine, that's the national monument, isn't it? Whoever asked that question. There's a national monument there, and that's a very old mine and really interesting. It was one of the richest copper deposits ever discovered. Some parts of the ore body had 70% copper in it. And that mine was started when? Before the turn of the last century or something, and it was, or early last century, and then it was shut down or was finally mined out in when? About 1935 or something like that. And so, 70% copper would, that would be a pretty easy property to mine. There aren't deposits like that around anymore.
What I will get to on that question is that, you know, that was mined in a time when we didn't have the environmental regulations that we have in place today. And right now, some of the best fish worldwide, some of the most coveted fish are the Copper River Reds. Where do they come from? Copper River. What was at the headwaters? A copper mine.
As to Ms. Shaw, you've mentioned that you've done some work and used to be apparently a salaried employee and now still do some work for the Fort Knox mine. Would the passage of ballot measure 4 affect any proposed expansion of the Fort Knox mine?
Today, no. The proposed expansion that's going forward right now is a heap leach facility, but what we don't know is what's going to come next. Right now they're doing a Phase 7 expansion in their mine, but they're continuing to do exploration. Additional facilities at that mine would fall under this initiative and would be affected. Right now, even the Fort Knox mine has been there for 10 years, more than 10 years, since 1996. They are building a new facility right now. It's a heap leach facility. It is not previously permitted. This is a new facility. Had this ballot measure already passed, it absolutely would fall under this ballot measure for the permitting process. So today, no, because the ballot measure hasn't passed. Future expansions, I can't tell you what they'll be. They're continuing to do exploration. And if there are new facilities that are built, and if there are permits that need to be renewed, DNR, DEC say that yes, it will be in effect for those future changes, permits, and facilities.
You know, that's a kind of disingenuous answer that's been driving me nuts for the last 8 months. Fort Knox knows the geology in the region of their mine generally. They're not out exploring blind. They know where they're going. They know what water bodies are in the vicinity of the mine where they might expand and whether or not these are salmon spawning streams. So they could say, yeah, if we go over here, we've got a couple salmon spawning streams, and yeah, it could impact us if we have to set our dumps back from them or something like that. But to say, you know, gosh, we just don't know, is just, I've never worked on a mine where, you know, I've worked in dozens of them, where the people operating the mine were clueless about the environment around them. But that's what these guys would have you believe, that the mine operators just have no idea what's happening around them.
And that's just, I don't want anybody to believe that mine operators don't know what's going on around them. Absolutely they do. We absolutely know what's going on around us. What we don't know is if we're going to be constructing new facilities. That's what we don't know. We're continuing to do exploration. We hope to be able to extend the life of all the mines in Alaska. But we don't know if we're going to be constructing additional facilities. When Fort Knox was permitted, it fell under the National Fisheries Management System. They had to do all of the same permitting because they could be in a tributary to a salmon spawning stream. So they had to go through all of that as if they were on a salmon spawning stream already. Absolutely. This will affect any future expansion. What I'm telling you that I don't know is whether or not there's going to be a new facility or future expansion.
And we've had a spirited discussion. We're on tape here tonight, so we're going to need to wrap up, although people can stay, I think, longer after we do this official wrap-up for broadcast. I'd like each of you to give your best 20 seconds at the end of the spirited discussion. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Switzer, and then go to you, Michelle.
How much time do I have?
Best 20 seconds you can give us.
Best 20 seconds. I'm way too old for that. best 20 seconds. Well, you know, I think this does not shut down mines. I haven't heard anybody explain to me how it will. And, you know, the mining industry and as far as transnational, you know, those horrible companies that operate in the third world, well, most of them are based here. And incidentally, as far as the Alaska mining industry is concerned, it's just an extension of the Canadian mining industry in Vancouver. All of these little companies that are working up here are based in Vancouver. In fact, because of the lack of Securities Exchange Commission regulations in Canada, most small American mining companies are basing in Vancouver and Toronto as well. But I think that, you know, ballot measure number 4 would send a strong message to the regulators. It would give a boost to HB 74, and it would make life more difficult for the Pebble project and might even kill it. But that's no guarantee.
Thanks a lot. Ms. Shaw, could you give us your most punchy 20 seconds?
It's a confusing issue. I will absolutely maintain that, but I think the good news is we have the facts on our side. I would encourage everybody here to do your own homework. Go to the DNR website. See what DEC has to say. Listen to Governor Palin. She is voting no on this, and her family fishes in Bristol Bay. She obviously understands the issue. The uncertainty is what is driving the mining industry's interest in this fight. We don't know what this measure will bring. That brings absolute difficulty in deciding where to invest your dollars. Why would a company want to come to invest in Alaska when they can't be assured that this is a place that they can do business? Bad way to make policy, bad policy decision for Alaska. And I would just urge everybody to make sure you vote no on Measure 4.
I want to thank both our speakers and also KSK and KCAN for recording the forum tonight. It's going to the rebroadcast times, this will be rebroadcast. The rebroadcast times are listed on our website. I want to thank our co-sponsors and all those who worked on the forum. I want to thank everybody who came out tonight. And I want to say, just like I usually say at the end of these discussions, go out next week and vote like you mean it. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to a public forum on ballot measures 3 and 4, hosted by Alaska Common Ground at the Wilda Marston Theater on August 20th, 2008. After hearing from both sides of each issue, what do you think? Should these initiatives become laws in Alaska? Will publicly funded campaigns and the proposed water quality regulations harm or benefit our state? We invite you to share your thoughts on our website, kska.org. In an effort to provide the information you need to make an informed decision on August 26th, we hope this public forum has sparked contemplation, reflection, and discussion. You can download it on our website at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA Public Radio, FM 91.1. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.